Well, hello everyone. Nice to see you all, and welcome to another episode of All Things Biosimilar this week with your co-hosts Alex and G. So this is my first
New co-host, yeah, Alex, new
new
co-host.
co-host. So just at the top here, I wanted to take a moment to introduce myself, Alex Keaton. I'm the executive director of the Biosimilars Council and SVP of Policy here at AAM, and really excited to join the team and get to work on all things biosimilars and all things biosimilars. So yeah, really excited, and definitely, I think, a pivotal time for the biosimilars industry writ large. Lots of things moving and shaking with biosimilars and with drug pricing generally. Today, though, we wanted to kind of hit on one of these announcements that's happened just in recent weeks that is really kind of bringing a lot of things into focus on the regulatory side of biosimilars, which was an October 29th announcement from the FDA. About comparative efficacy studies and some hopeful final guidance related to interchangeability. You know, these two things have been priorities of AAM and the Biosimilars Council for some time. So really exciting to see some movement in that space. But obviously a lot of, you know, it's quite complex. You know, manufacturers are going to have to look at these draft and hopefully final guidances and decide what that really means for them. And still a lot of unanswered questions about kind of what this means for the broader biosimilars marketplace moving forward and what else can be done to streamline regulatory development, bring biosimilars to market. So with that, you know, G, you know, from your perspective in Cyreg, as you look at these announcements, what are they really, what do you think they mean to manufacturers, and how do you think manufacturers are gonna take those up and run with them?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. Hi, everyone. Again, this is our third in a series of, I think it's six is the intention. So this is our third, and welcome, Alex. Looking forward to having a new co-host. We really appreciate you being here. Well, see, the announcement was great, right? So the announcements was made at it was first announced by the FDA. The draft guidance was released minutes before the FDA Commissioner, Dr. McCarry, stepped onto our stage at GRX and Biosimilars, which is our yearly conference, and he talked about this draft guidance. And this is a welcome shift from manufacturers and our members. And the idea here is, of course, that it, essentially, in many cases, the large, expensive comparative efficacy studies may not be needed for the biosimilar development, which is great because, to your point, you know, there's a concern. There's a concern right now, and it's a valid and real concern of, you know, where is the modality of biosimilars, and will it be able to sustain itself? Is the business proposition that was developed years ago in 2010-ish with BBCIA, is it still a viable business? And of course, we believe that it can be, should be, and will be, because if we do this and we do it right, and as we do it right, we're going to have more products to patients at a less cost, so that increases access to these very important drugs. You know, biologics in general itself. Biologics are not a huge portion of the drugs or the medicines that are prescribed in this country. I think it's like 5%. So from a government perspective, I think it was like 5% of the federal plans, if I recall correctly. And I think it's like upwards of 50% of their
Above,
spending, right? So the cost is incredible. So, and not only is the cost incredible for purchasing and using these products, but the cost to develop them. And that's the catch. So what's the cost to develop the research and development? And this type of change, this wonderful shift of the FDA and their current thinking, will bring down the cost. It brings down the time to develop these products. So the draft guidance, which by the way is still out now for public comment, which our members will comment on at a high level, is very impactful and a very good and welcome shift in thinking.
You know, one of the things that we've talked about kind of when we think about the regulatory environment and biosimilars is how in a lot of ways, you know, the science of biosimilars was outpacing kind of the regulatory structure of them, right? And so I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like this, you know, perhaps a little later than we would have liked, but definitely represents kind of the regulators meeting the science where it is and where it's developed.
Right. You know, in our space, I think maybe many can argue in many different spaces, if you will. Traditionally, or typically, the regulator is somewhat behind, or at least falls a little bit behind the evolution, the newness of, for example, in our world, the science and where we evolved. So the tests, for example, so what they're going to do is rely on more comparability analytical data, right? Structural and functional data. These tests over the last 10, 15 years, these assays, et cetera, have gotten very good, and they've gotten more specific. They can really explain and show that there's comparability much, much better than what some would call blunt instrument of a clinical trial. So that science, now that those tests have gotten better and we could show more comparability, or now, hey, here's how we're showing you it's highly similar, it actually meant that the FDA has to move a little faster on shifting some of their thinking. And I'll be honest, in general, not just in the drug space, but in general, while the regulators are sometimes slower than the business revolution, and I have to give the FDA credit. I mean, it's old. This modality theoretically has only been around for 15 years,
Right.
right? And this is a big shift. So you got to give them some kudos to my colleagues at the FDA. It's a big shift in thinking. So we're proud where they are, and we hope to continue and want to continue working with them on continuing to embracing the science, which many of them talk about and do. So while slower than we want, typically, usually, right? We always want faster, faster, faster. But it's actually a pretty remarkable thing they've come around this fast. It's a kudos to the FDA.
So when we think about this draft guidance, right? We're talking about comparative efficacy studies to demonstrate biosimilarity. So thinking about the implications for industry, you kind of touched on this a little bit already, but without the need to conduct these additional kind of superfluous studies, manufacturers are looking at the timelines for biosimilar development as being much shorter and less expensive than they are today. So I want to turn maybe a little bit to the second part of the announcement.
Sure. Well,
From
before, hey, Alex, if you don't mind, before we leave that, just one more thing on that. You may want to touch on it later, but just while we're here, it would behoove us to bring up the Void paper, right? So in February, right, February 2025, almost, goodness, time flies, about a year ago, we released the Void paper, essentially, is what we termed it, and essentially that talked about the lack of development in biosimilars, right? So it talked about, I think there's 118 patents and exclusivities that are going to expire in the next 10 years. And of those 118, don't hold me to the exact number, but I think it was around 12 that we were aware of through
10%,
help with IQVIA that are under development. So it's a very, very small number. And it goes back to, okay, what about the sustainability of this business and the biosimilar modality? Will people continue to develop these products that they can develop? And a good number of them were products that have a return, that are helping patients, but also getting money back to the manufacturers. So there's a business proposition there as well. And with this type of small change, we're hoping, we believe, manufacturers now consider, okay, you know what? We just reduced the time, we just reduced the cost. Maybe now they'll look into some of those products that they weren't considering in the past and say, hey, let's look into doing some research and develop on this product. And that's the hope. That's what we hope to see, which would be great because, again, more products out there, more competition, lower cost, better access for patients.
I think that's what, when we talk about our policy priorities, whether they're on the regulatory side or the payer side, all of these things that the Biosimilars Council and AAM advocate for are trying to look at the kind of cost benefit
Yeah.
that manufacturers are doing when they think about, where should I invest my time and resources? And right now there's a lot, there's a lot of costs, like a lot of risks on the biosimilar side. And so any change that we can make to just bring that risk down a
That's
little
right.
bit more, to say like, ah, no, like, we're going to eliminate, redundant comparative efficacy studies, where we're going to get rid of, and again, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but interchangeability designations. We're going to make changes in the payer side to ensure that there's a robust and sustainable market for these products, and just to tip the scales a little bit, so that manufacturers say like, no, this is a sustainable market where we're going to develop these products. I think that's kind of our goal.
That's exactly right. And I'm looking forward to one of the future one of the future podcasts, and we talk about more of the payer side.
Yeah.
That'll be good, and that'll be on you. I get to hammer you with questions. I can't wait.
Absolutely. It'll be fun. It'll be fun.
I would say you mentioned briefly switching studies, right? So you mentioned and you
Yeah.
talked about interchangeability. And I'm sure you were going to go there next before I threw the void
Yeah. No,
out there.
the void is always a good thing to remember.
That's an interesting one too. And this is something we've talked about for some time. So, it's the designation, the dual designation of biosimilar and interchangeable. We're the only country that really has it, right? And the FDA has been using, once again, very good language around, Sarim and others. They've talked about, look, once it's biosimilars in our mind, we're saying it's safe and effective. We're saying it's just as potent. So in their mind, I think this is what they're thinking, that they're already saying it's interchangeable. Now there's legislative issues, right? And before I talk about that from a scientific perspective and a quality perspective, they've always agreed, interchangeability is not a higher designation of higher quality, of higher safety. That's not the case at all. It is a legislative designation. It's a designation where the pharmacist can simply substitute a biosimilar. But and there's legislation that's being considered now, right? As far as once you're biosimilar, you're also considered interchangeable. And why that's important is because, since the passing of BBCIA and biosimilar, the one designation of biosimilar and the other designation of interchangeable, you have a bunch of states out there that have actually, good or bad, you can debate it, but have used that as far as in how they might put stuff on certain levels or certain tiers when it comes to in formularies, when it comes to substitution. So it's a really good thing to say, okay, let's see how we can potentially get rid of the word interchangeable without really getting rid of the word. So it's a very good thing. And once again, reduction of the need of a switching study, for example, will save time, money, will save cost. You're getting products to patients faster. And that's the end. I've said it three, four times now. That's the end goal. Admittedly, 100%. This is a business. You're in a business. Yeah, these businesses have to thrive. I get that. But they're in a wonderful business because they're in the business to help patients. They're in the business to develop these wonderful products and to give patients better access at a reduction of the cost so they can get these needed medicines. So it's a good business to be in. And it's always fun to say, okay, look, now this is how I can save some money, time, et cetera. Let's do it faster, get it to patients faster.
Yeah, ab absolutely. And I think that, like you said, it's really encouraging to hear kind of the FDA from their scientific perspective say, like, look, we understand that this is, a construct that Congress has created, but from a scientific perspective, it's kind of, we've moved past that. But I think that dynamic speaks to why, like, while these announcements are really great, one of the things that can provide like the highest level of certainty to manufacturers as they look at this is congressional action to, for example, eliminate the interchangeable designation and just say, look, buying this is something that we had as this market was getting on its feet, but as we've talked about, the science has kind of moved beyond it. And as you said, I think from our perspective too, it's really important to note the state laws surrounding substitution of pharmaceutical product, and for as important and sort of monumental as it is for the FDA to acknowledge that this designation doesn't really make sense anymore, there are tons of state law triggers that are tied to that designation. And so ultimately, I do think it's important that we have Congress act and kind of get to where the FDA already is and the scientific community already is and just say, like, we can get rid of this.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And a lot of people and a lot of experts, when this modality once again was first developed in this country a long time ago, there was some trepidation, there was some concern from physicians because it's new. It's almost history repeating itself. And I wasn't in the business back in the day, but when the generics came on board in the US in the early 80s, it was the same thing where it's kind of a re repeated itself. History repeated itself with biosimilars. There's a trust element there, right? Well, we've come a long way there too, because And speaking with physicians and patient groups, there is that trust now. They do understand these products go through a robust regulatory review at the FDA. And once they get that quote unquote seal of approval from the FDA, they do trust these products. So now it becomes a game and not a very fun game of, okay, what do we do from a payer's perspective? What do we do from, how do we get these products across the finish line? So, because I've heard stories of, physicians want to prescribe that
Yeah.
biosimilar, and they just can't. He just can't.
Yeah. I think that's one of the just going back to the void paper for a second, one of the findings that I think is most telling and like really makes the void kind of like you understand the tangible impact of it, right? Which is that, you mentioned the 118 products that IQVIA looked at where there's patent expiry on the horizon, but no product in development. And they looked at not just like what those products are, but the therapy areas where those products are targeted. And you see that they're not, the products that are facing patent expiry that don't have product pipeline, they're not sort of like spread evenly across therapeutic classes, right? And so when you have that kind of clustering of biosimilar development, I mean that's great for patients in those therapeutic areas, but obviously for those that aren't, it's not only sort of the immediate sort of lack of competition and lower cost options for those products, but it's also an enormous missed opportunity for providers who are treating those diseases to become familiar with biosimilars, to understand how they're therapeutically equivalent, and creating that kind of bedrock of trust in the biosimilars market that's going to be necessary if it's going to thrive. So just another reason why it's so important to kind of address the biosimilar void.
Yeah, I agree. And again, going a little bit further on the void, we actually once again had Sarah Yim, who's the director of OTBB, as many know, at the FDA. And at our conference, we had a nice fireside chat with her. And she's always very, very, she's wonderful to talk to. She's very bright. She knows the business of the FDA. She understands our business. She understands the science. She's a remarkable person. And she talked briefly about this void because I asked her. So we looked in the numbers that we could see publicly, and we asked her essentially, are these numbers about right? And she couldn't validate necessarily because they can't necessarily volunteer all the information the FDA has, but she didn't disagree. And she talked about some of these tools that they're putting in place to try to prevent that and to try to encourage manufacturers to looking into different types of products, to you're saying maybe different therapeutic areas as well, to think about this, to think about, yes, we should do some research, we should develop these products, let's look into doing that. So it was nice having her mention that as well, so they know it's out there, they get it. Again, couldn't 100% validate the exact numbers, but there was no disagreement on the this is truly an issue.
Yeah. I think maybe to kind of close out a little bit, we've touched on this a couple of times already, but ultimately what this is about is patients, right? About providing patients with additional therapeutic options. One of the things I've noticed, especially in the weeks following this announcement, is that folks have, come to us and ask us questions about what this means, how will this impact patients. And it's a little bit tough, right? Because whenever we talk about pharmaceutical development, we're talking about comparatively long time horizons, right? These two pieces of draft and then hopefully final guidance in the next couple of months are about, studies that manufacturers have to conduct today that they won't have to conduct in the future. So I think it can sometimes be a little bit confusing about what the tangible impact of announcements like these mean. I think we both understand it, but like capturing that in a way that is going to be meaningful to patients. I'm curious if you've, I mean, we've kind of danced around it a little bit, but how to characterize this thing that we know is so helpful, but like for a wider audience.
Absolutely. And just to reset, one thing is, as you mentioned, so the draft guidance for comparative efficacy studies, that's out now.
Right.
The interchangeability one, that's not out yet, but we're
Yeah.
anticipating out, and hopefully in the next 3 to 6 months, Dr. McCary, graciously decided to come to our conference, as I mentioned, did mention that they're working on that as well. And ideally, in the next 3 to 6 months, that'll be out too. As far as, I mean, look, at a high, I try to simplify things in my mind. At a high level, This just means increased competition.
Yep.
And in our world, in the US, increased competition, you're talking about when you deliver a product that's just as good, so it's a high quality product. So where's the win? How do you sell more of any product? If it's the same quality, you lower the cost. And that's what's going to happen here. So biosimilars will lower the cost. In fact, I think we had a recent study, and it's terrible. I don't know the name. My apologies, but talked about, in the generic side, I think it's 3 to 5 products when
Oh,
there's
yeah.
3 to 5 competitors out there on generic side. That's where you see a tremendous decrease in cost for generics. The biosimilar side, we saw it's, I believe the number is like two or
Two.
three. You see a 33%, if not more, decrease in cost. So at a high level, to keep it simple for me, is you have more high quality products out there that's just as safe, just as efficacious, just as potent because it's a biosimilar. But it's going to be at a reduced cost. And now the catch here is how do we get that reduced cost to the patient? That's the catch. And that's what we want to try to help provide as well.
I think that can cover us pretty
Could
much
be
well
it.
for today.
Not bad.
Not a bad first podcast,
Yeah,
and I
this is
think,
Alex Ferd pot first podcast ever, folks. So this is a big deal.
but I think we've teed up some nice questions for future ones as well, and I hope you'll hold me to the payer based
Will
conversation,
do. Oh,
because
absolutely. You can count
Right, that's the second part of the equation, right? Is like it's not just about getting them approved and to market, it's about getting them paid for.
That's right. That's step one. So all the FDA and all this wonderful stuff that's going on in the regulatory space in our space, right? Once we get those approved and they're out there, okay, next step. And some may argue it's even harder. How do we get them to patients? Yeah.
It's a hurdle for sure, but we happy to talk about that too.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, thanks for
Awesome.
joining me, Alex. This was great. Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Yeah, thanks. Good first podcast.
All right. Take care, everyone. See you next time.
Bye bye.